All right, welcome back to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr., your loyal host and producer, who would like to ask you a question about travel. How many of you have ever visited Russia? Maybe you went there on a missions trip. Maybe you went there for business. There are, you know, a number of reasons that people may visit Russia. What did you think about the architecture as you looked at the buildings? What did you think about the foods? And, you know, I'm just kind of assuming that while you were there, you kind of engaged with the culture on some level. Well, you know, some people have actually gone to Russia in times past to find work. You know, we have people who are migrating from one part of the world to another part of the world, all over the world, looking for a better life, trying to get work so that they can feed themselves and that they have families, take care of their families. Well, courtesy of BBC, in fact, there are a few conversations I'd like for you to hear on BBC now. Well, at least one. And this has, let's make it a few. Starting with this one. A gentleman who made a trip to Russia with his intentions being to stay there for maybe about a year or so. I want you to find out how long he actually ended up staying there and why.
In December 1929, I first saw a group of Russians. They went around for a while and then they spotted me. The leader of the group said, "Would you like to come to Soviet Russia and teach our young people?"
By the way, the man that you're hearing, well, you'll hear it. Keep listening.
Was going through the Great Depression.
America was going through the Depression.
All around me at the forts, people were being discharged. Being a black man, I expected mine any day. Being the provisor for my mother, I said, "Well, I'll go for 1 year." And they were giving me more pay than I was earning. That's how come I went to the Soviet Union. I knew nothing about Soviet Russia. They would run up to me and say, "Дядя, почему вы так черный? Why are you so dark?" My answer to them would be, "That's the way I was born." When my contract had gone, was about 10 months old, I was called and asked to stay another year. And since the Depression was still on, I decided to stay another 1 year. One morning, I went to work as usual. There was a meeting going on, selecting people for the Moscow Soviet. One man got up and said, "Comrade, I have no other name than that of Robert Robbins." I was shocked. Without my consent, against my will, I was never asked. Here I was elected to the Moscow Soviet, a foreigner. After being elected to Moscow City Council, the Americans took away my citizenship. I took Soviet citizenship because there was no other way out. But I regretted it, and I will ever regret having done so. I felt threatened every day in my life because they look on me, as they told me many, many times, "You may have a Soviet citizenship, but you're still a foreigner." I was being watched in my factory every day by five different people. I would be provoked for me to say something either against the government or the system itself. I used to go to bed with my clothes on, ready whenever the KGB came, I wouldn't have to dress. I never allowed myself to become lonely. I listened to the BBC, if I am at home on Sundays, all day long. And I would put the music on, take a chair as my lady, and dance.
Interestingly enough, we were hearing from Robert Robinson, posthumously, if you will. He was finally allowed to return to the USA, the report goes on to say, in 1986. And he died in 1994. Wow. What tragedy. He went over there to be there for 1 year, just one, only one, just 1 year. And again, because there was that was the time of the Great Depression in America. People were being laid off, as he said, and he was fairly certain that his day was coming. He was approached by people from the Soviet Russia, who offered him an opportunity to work there. He jumped at the opportunity. 1 week. I'm sorry, 1 year. It was just supposed to last 1 year. He was being paid better than he was being paid in America. He was offered an opportunity to work another year after he completed that first year. So he decided, okay, one more year. And it was during that second year that, as he mentioned, against his will, he was elected to office. Against his will. As a result, his American citizenship was revoked by Americans. And so in order to survive, he took on the Soviet, the Russian citizenship. As he mentioned, he always regretted it. But finally, it was around 1929 when he went to Russia. It was 1986 when he was finally allowed to return to America. They say that he spent roughly 50 years in Russia. Finally allowed to return to America, and 8 years later died. He only enjoyed the country of his birth for roughly 8 years after returning. What do you think about that, ladies and gentlemen? How about this whole idea of going to another country that you may not consider to be your first choice? Whatever that country would be, think of any country in Europe, any country on the continent of Africa, any country in South America, any country that would not be your first, second, or fourth choice. But out of necessity, in order to survive, in order to make it, not only for yourself, but for at least one other family member, you went there with the intentions of being there just for a short while. This isn't even a trip now, a vacation type deal where you plan to be there for 2 or 3 weeks and come on back home. 1 year out of necessity. Not to do missions work because you just want to do it and want to do the missions work in that country. No, you're going to that country for the purpose of surviving. And it is not one of your top five choices. Next thing you know, 45 years later, you're still there. And again, not by choice. Would that be a nightmare to you? Would that be a 50-year-long nightmare to you? Or do you suppose that maybe after year three, you'd be adjusting well enough that you'd be okay with that situation? Can you imagine dancing with the chairs, listening to the music, listening to TV broadcasts, week after week, month after month, year after year, for 10, 20, 30, 40 years? And that is your entertainment? That is your solace? I can't help but wonder if he spent time socializing with someone in all that time. I tell you what, life can sure throw some curves, can't it? Well, let's take a listen now to this whole issue of the Asian company that is building this 5G network. Actually, they built it. And there are many in America who are saying, we don't want you dealing with that company's 5G network. Take a listen.
When you think about cybersecurity, you probably imagine really boring images like this. But there's a much better way to think about it. Instead, imagine this.
A castle.
Imagine a castle as a super secure computer network. Inside that castle is the data. Let's call it the crown jewels.
With all that security, how would you get in? Well, you might use a secret passageway. In other words, a backdoor.
So what is a cyber backdoor? Let's ask a woman who once led a Homeland Security team protecting the US from them.
So you've built your castle, you've built the moat around it, and all of your guards looking out, ready to defeat any adversary, except that you've got somebody inside the castle who has actually dug a tunnel and hidden it, and that is a kind of a backdoor.
Cyber backdoors can be built through software or hardware. The fears around them are growing daily, and there's one company that keeps coming up in the headlines, the world's biggest telecoms firm, Huawei. Around the world, the Chinese giant is facing scrutiny, restrictions, or even bans. So where does this fear come from?
Well, it's not about Huawei phones, it's about the kit being installed and tested around the world to build the next generation of mobile internet, 5G.
5G technology is going to fundamentally support every aspect of our lives.
Brian Lord is a former deputy head of GCHQ. He spent more than 20 years at the cyber spy organization.
And Huawei are one of the world leaders in 5G technology. The problem with Huawei, amongst others, is that its connection with the Chinese state, although Huawei continue to insist they are a completely private company, are still very, very opaque and therefore create a level of distrust.
A lot of the concern centers around this man, Ren Zhengfei, the billionaire founder of the company. Mr. Ren has been on an interview spree lately. He's a big supporter of China's Communist Party and a former technician in the Chinese military, but he's been trying to reassure people that despite his connections, he would never allow backdoors to be installed in his products for the government.
So how dangerous can cyber backdoors really be? Well, here are some doomsday scenarios.
A backdoor to the inner walls of our cyber castle could give spies access to phone calls or internet communications. It might be possible to maliciously damage or even cripple the way information is shared. And some even fear a sort of kill switch that could take out large chunks of the network. Huawei denies that any of this could or would happen. And as well as spending billions on improving security, it started fighting back.
Today, Huawei announced it has filed a lawsuit against the US government.
Yet the company is suing US authorities for banning its equipment, but winning trust is proving difficult.
A lot of it seems to come down to the perceived culture of the company. For years, it and the Chinese government have been accused of intellectual property theft. And right now in the US, a court case is taking place with Huawei accused of bank fraud, obstruction of justice, and the theft of technology. But none of that has anything to do with cyber back doors. So is there any proof that this is a real danger?
There's been no smoking gun. I would not be the least bit surprised if the Chinese government is holding off on using its advantage that it might have with Huawei.
Some China analysts believe the technology fears are masking a bigger power struggle.
China was in that catch-up phase, but nowadays it's in the face of rather formidable competitors with the Western companies. And I think the so-called liberal democracy feel deeply uncomfortable about it.
The Chinese government says these sorts of allegations are all about politics. They even invoke Jane Austen in their defense. The allegations, an official said, are part of a deep-rooted pride and prejudice against China.
Regardless of how relations develop, 5G is coming. And there's a concern in the telecoms world that the countries that decide to block Huawei's state-of-the-art kit will be leagues behind those that embrace it.
So what are your thoughts about that? So far, we're told there's no smoking gun with regards to back doors with the 5G network that Huawei is developing. Should we be concerned? They're saying that lawsuits and some of the other actions being taken against Huawei have nothing to do with back doors. So how should we respond to all of this? What should our concerns be? Should we be concerned that the founder and CEO of Huawei, supporter of the Chinese Communist government, should we just say, okay, well, hey, so he's a supporter of the Chinese Communist government. Big deal. I'm just asking, what are your thoughts about it? Should we be concerned about the backdoor issue? That's the main thing, which would give access to phone calls, etc. 5G network, do you say, well, maybe we should just kind of slow down and maybe get to a point where not only China, but other countries are well along the way of developing 5G so that we don't have to depend on one country's development of that technology. And we'll have choices. What are your thoughts? All right, let me let you think about that for a few, and I will be back in a few.